The Piano Concerto No. 2 in B-flat by Johannes Brahms. A concerto that thinks it's a symphony, according to this evening's conductor, Simon Rattle. A concerto that you have to play like chamber music, according to soloist Yefim Bronfman, who adores playing with the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra for exactly that reason, as he was telling us earlier. And as soon as that concerto had finished, embraces, bear hugs, mutual appreciation all round. It's quite obvious how much the orchestra and conductor enjoys playing with Bronfman. The warmth and humour exhibited as they got together at rehearsal this morning was unusual, to say the least. And Bronfman back on stage, immediately embracing the principal cellist at the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, Ludwig Pfant, for the quality of those solos at each end of the beautifully sustained third movement. Bronfman and Rattle, hand in hand, acknowledging the cheers of the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall. I love what Brahms said about this concerto in a letter to a friend just after he'd written it. "I've just finished a tiny, tiny piano concerto with a tiny, tiny wisp of a scherzo." Anything but. And just in case you were wondering where this puts it amongst his other works, it was 12 years after the first piano concerto, by which time Brahms had also written his first two symphonies and the violin concerto. Simon Rattle indicating to Bronfman that he should take the bow on his own. Bronfman attempting to drag him to the front of the stage with him, Rattle hanging back, but here they are, both of them together again. Every member of the orchestra either tapping their bows in appreciation or applauding. And of course, Simon Rattle brings the principal horn player of the orchestra, Stefan Dorf, to his feet. That opening solo is such a key point to setting the tone for the whole work. I saw Bronfman greeting the Berlin Philharmonic's principal flautist, Emanuel Paud, like an old friend backstage today with a very warm embrace. It turns out they've been together on a major recital tour recently, from Spain to London via Turkey and Denmark. What's next? Well, Bronfman was telling me he's looking forward to a late summer break after this prom. But then he's in Munich at the end of September. He's artist in residence with the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra. And there are going to be some concerts in the Zurich Turnhalle with David Zinman. Pretty thunderous ovation now from everybody here in the hall. And back on its feet once again, the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. Bronfman and Rattle, arms around each other, bowing low. Rattle still congratulating the wind players for their part in that performance. Well, after Brahms's monumental piano concerto, the second half of this evening's Berlin Philharmonic prom also contains just a single work, unless that is we're favoured with an encore. It could happen, no one's sure. Anyway, the main work is a piece written a century after Brahms's concerto, the Symphony No. 3 by Polish composer Witold Lutosławski, of whose music Mr. Rattle is a huge fan, so expect some fascinating sounds from the Berliners as he engages with Lutosławski's vision of a symphonic drama for the late 20th century. Until then, our Proms Plus interval feature takes us across the road to the Royal College of Music, where earlier this evening I took part in a discussion on the subject of the future of orchestras with the Financial Times critic and Berlin-based journalist Shirley Apthorpe and the director of the Association of British Orchestras, Mark Pemberton.
What people are beginning to look at is, what does it mean to be an orchestra? Is it just the great music on the concert platform performed to those who have paid a ticket to come through the door? Or is it something that goes much deeper than that, which has much greater levels of social responsibility, which engages with the community that is on its doorstep, and also engages with music education, engages with the schools in its locality, that becomes a social resource that is therefore even more vital to the city?
Well, Shirley, give us an idea of what the Berlin Philharmonic does on the ground, because they're, Simon Rattle's very proud of the orchestra's social contribution these days, isn't he?
Yes, he is, and that is really a change that has happened within the orchestra since his arrival in 2002, I believe, that they have changed the kind of education work they do and the kinds of communities that they reach out to through their education, so that now the orchestra is really going out into communities and schools and prisons and old people's homes and interacting in a direct way, doing creative work, engaging the young people as creative contributors. They make their own pieces, they make films, and they have performances in the Philharmonie and, of course, in the arena. The dance projects have been well documented. In some ways, an equally significant change for the orchestra is its own perception of its function in the community, as much as it is important for the way the community perceives the orchestra. But for the players themselves to go out and work with the rough kids in some of the less economically privileged corners of Germany has been a shift in perspective for them themselves in terms of what it means to be a musician and what the orchestra can be for society.
And Shirley, I should add, of course, that that was after he'd been in the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. So yes. I suspect he brought the British model across to Germany.
He began with Richard McNichol, that many of the team came from a British perception. Yeah. And I think that there was very much a perception in Germany that we can learn from looking at the British models there. Of course, you need to be careful of always this debate of saying we don't need to worry about music in schools now because the orchestras are looking after that. It's not the outcome that one would wish for.
But having said that, what would your view, Mark, be of music education? Do we have the... We hear all the arguments about funding of music in schools and the difference of levels of music education between private and public education. But the teaching, the quality of the teaching available is still very high.
Yes,
here,
we have got a very well-honed structure that we've had that we built up over decades. And we can take great pride in the way in which music education has worked in this country. Yes, there's been some rocky moments along the way, and we should also give credit that the current government is continuing to invest public money into music education and has retained music in the national curriculum, certainly at primary school level. So it's still there, and we still have a very great network of music services now adapting into this new music education hubs that are coming into being, which actually are meant to be about creating more partnerships crossing local authority boundaries. And certainly have put professional orchestras at the heart of what it means to be working in partnership and creating the best possible offer for music education in schools.
What about the students leaving music colleges and other places where they've been studying music at tertiary level? They seem to be better equipped to survive in the world they find out there, even if the jobs for life that they might have expected to see years ago aren't quite available in the same way.
I think it's interesting, and we're talking with our good friends in the music conservatoires, and you can see that maybe students have different expectations now. It isn't so much, well, I will graduate and I will join an orchestra and I will be given my chair and I will sit in the same chair for 40 years and then I will retire and get my clock. It actually is much more about a flexible portfolio career, dipping in and out, exploring different repertoire, shifting genre, and being perhaps more of a creative artist than perhaps, though I'm sure, I imagine some older orchestra musicians might like what I'm saying. Just, it just feels like there it is a younger generation who are hungry for adaptability.
And Shirley, is this something that the German music colleges would recognise, or are we a little ahead of them even in this regard?
I'm on thin ice here, I must say, because my expertise in the area is limited, but from what I have seen, I would have to say it sounds quite utopic what's happening here, if it's like that. I'm fairly sure that only one of the New York tertiary music institutions offers a course which equips young people to go out and make their own way in today's music world. On the whole, on a global scale, music institutions still function very much on the 19th century model, and students are graduating from music institutions qualified for jobs which don't exist and not equipped with the tools that they would need to make their own livelihood, to invent their own forms, to earn a living, to create the future. I don't feel nearly enough is being invested on average in music institutions in equipping students to do more than just play their instruments or sing. Singing is another terrible case in point, where all these kids are leaving in music institutions trained for jobs which simply don't exist. And I think the longer term concern is whether tomorrow's politicians are going to have the same kind of understanding of what one could call the intangible values. Why do we need music? Why do we need culture? And with politicians coming into politics more and more directly from a training in straight politics and less from broader community bases, not necessarily with a background in culture at all, you can begin to fret about whether the situation may deteriorate, but I think it's far too soon to have that debate, and there are far too many interesting things happening in other areas, especially in technology, to have that concern.
I just wonder if you'd agree with that, Mark, because I'm thinking with all of the success at an elite level in sport, for example, you must be concerned that there's going to be a massive funding switch from arts to sport. It's an open goal for politicians.
Before I get that, I actually want to touch on the sport analogy in some other way, which to do with this issue of quality of orchestras. Mm. Another thing to bear in mind in terms of British orchestras are increasing internationalisation. We're in a global marketplace now. We're in competition with orchestras across the world. But what we're also finding is that musicians from other countries want to come and work in Britain. And they are attracted by our orchestras, they're attracted by their enterprise and their reputation. So you're now beginning to see more nationalities within the orchestras. We're able to go out there and attract the very best musicians from across the world. And that is much like Premiership football teams. And so arguably the quality has increased through globalisation. And not to get too political, therefore, obviously, that means that you've got to have a visa system working that enables you to be able to attract the very best.
And we've read all sorts of problems with that kind of thing. So does it work in the other direction as well? Because we've got emerging markets in terms of orchestral playing. We've got new areas, growth areas for appreciation of Western classical music, new orchestras and organisations springing up in the Far East, the Middle East, India, more opportunities for our own musicians.
Yes, absolutely, and we are very interested in the developments, particularly in China and other Far Eastern countries, where there seems to be now a hunger for Western classical music, a desire to learn from the very best orchestras from across the world. We believe we're slightly in competition with Germany in terms of that marketplace and making sure that we're in there first and we're getting some of the good opportunities. But equally, being China, it's quite likely that, in fact, they will very quickly develop their own orchestras of very good quality.
And are they using the same business models as us? How are they attracting audiences and subscribers?
Yes, it's interesting that. I mean, we found our orchestras are going out there to find that it's slightly difficult because, of course, China does not have a culture of selling tickets. It's a communist country. It's expected to be free, and tickets are given away to party members who then don't show up. So there's some issue around getting people into the concert halls and educating them in the way in which you behave in the concert hall. But
so
they're really hungry.
So you have to add value to the ticket by charging for it to get people to value it enough to turn up for the concert.
So they are now actually exploring, what can they learn from us around marketing and selling tickets and being able to understand how you attract an audience.
But if you head in that direction, it's not going to take long before you end up with the same elitist arguments that we have. It's for the privileged, it's for people who can afford it. It's sort of heading at it from the other direction.
There's nothing elitist about selling tickets as long as the tickets are priced sensitively. That whole accusation of elitism, as you only have to look in the Albert Hall tonight or any other night during the proms to see a completely non-elitist activity where for £5 you can stand and listen to great music.
Is it the same in Berlin?
Yes, I would say that ticket prices are very accessible there, and you'll find a culture where there's not the stigma that I sometimes encounter in Britain of this, music is for toffs and only fancy people go to concerts. Your average Berliner would sit down in the evening and think, will I go out for dinner? Will I see a movie? Might I go to the Philharmonie or should I see the opera? And that's partly because there are so many institutions that you can generally get affordable tickets on the night. Your average seat in an opera house or concert hall is subsidised per night to the tune of €200 by the government. So they keep the ticket prices low so that anyone can go, and there isn't nearly as much a negative stigma attached to doing something that others might consider.
Well, that figure for the subsidy per seat brings up that another interesting part of the bums on seats analogy, because if you have a full concert hall, there's only so much more you can do with that space, aren't you? And if you're already running at a loss, as we know perfectly well, that if you have a big symphony orchestra playing a glamorous concert in a major venue in London, it's run at a loss, and you have to recoup the money somewhere else. How are people exploring these new ideas, new platforms, new opportunities for generating revenue?
I mean, let's also look at the digital concert hall of the Berlin Philharmonic, which is an interesting development where the digital concert hall is not just an internet platform, it's a high-D broadcast via the internet and via more and more end devices like Sony television screens, so that anybody who has the technology anywhere in the world can subscribe to hear every Berlin Philharmonic concert live and in the archives. They don't have a problem selling tickets to their concerts worldwide, so it's not because they don't have enough people going or even that there's not enough attention paid for them, but it's in a kind of scientific exploration, in a sense, of how we can use new technology to make what they do available to everybody. And the premise is that what an orchestra like the Berlin Philharmonic does notionally belongs to everybody on the planet. It's something that everybody ought to be able to have access to, and which by the limited number of seats in a concert hall is not possible. So I think it's very interesting that the internet and related technology is democratizizing access to symphonic music.
But it's democratizing access, but at the same time there's a creation of the expectation that it will be free. Yeah. You've still got
to have
a subscriber model.
I'm totally skeptical that they can ever generate revenue. It is, however, a fantastic tool for broadening reach, extending your reach out to people who are unable to come to the concert hall. And we've got some very interesting initiatives going on here, and you're right, there is also political pressure that if you are recipients of public funding, the public have already paid for it, and therefore it should be given away for free. It's been quite interesting to see the recent experiment with The Space, which was a joint initiative between the BBC and Arts Council England, around putting arts content through a free digital channel, and some really interesting stuff out there. That may be the sorts of area that we're interested in exploring, about making sure that we're using digital means to reach new audiences and to make them aware of the brand of that orchestra and to make sure that that orchestra is not seen as being wrapped, cocooned inside the bubble of its concert hall, but genuinely wants to reach out to as many people as possible.
So it is, again, it's another aspect of the outreach program, isn't it? And you mentioned brand, and people are beginning to turn to the idea that these kinds of digital platforms and this kind of internet availability is about branding more than it is about revenue.
Mm. And what we do see through young people's use of digital technology, and I'm a middle-aged man, so what do I know, is that it is a lot about word of mouth, friends, conversations, I like this. And that's what it's a fantastic boon to us, is just to create a buzz about the work that we're doing.
Does it generate a new audience for a classical symphony orchestra in concert?
I think it's too early to say.
I agree that it's difficult to measure that kind of thing. But for instance, one of the things that the Berlin Philharmonic have created in there, exploring what you can do with 3D technology, is they made a Nintendo game in 3D with the orchestra, which went out on Nintendo, and that will certainly bring the kind of audience into contact with the orchestra who would never ordinarily find themselves in a concert hall. I think certainly we're reaching more people, we're broadening access. On the other hand, everyone who sees a movie hears a symphony orchestra, so we do come into contact.
And after all, I can't say whether it brings a new audience, but the sheer fact that the numbers I quoted at the start about the 4 million ticket sales during a year is not suggesting that we have an audience dying out and audience numbers are going down. So maybe, actually, the resilience of our audience numbers is precisely because we are investing in extending our reach.
I'd like to come in completely from the side here and mention Venezuela. Anyone on YouTube can see a quote where Simon Rattle says, "I have seen the future of music in Venezuela." It was a country where they had one symphony orchestra in the early 70s, and most of the instrumentalists were from Eastern Europe. And one man, many of you will have heard the name, José Antonio Abreu, decided to start training young musicians who were Venezuelan. He began with 4 kids in a parking garage, and the next day he had 8, and after that there were 11. Today there are 400,000 young people in Venezuela, most of them from low income families playing in orchestras. They have 135 orchestras through the country with only Venezuelan musicians, some of them professional, some of them quite high-level professional. And they have an average audience age of under 35. Also, while we're on that subject, a friend visiting from Korea who went to a concert in Central Europe and said, "That's so interesting what you do here. You seem to have special concerts for old people."
Oh, that's fantastic. But it's a model which a lot of people have been desperate to export and to install in other places. We have Big Noise in Scotland, and which has been very successful. I was talking to violinist Nicola Benedetti about that at her prom very recently. And usually you've got your own version based around singing in South Africa, haven't you, which is sort of Sistema-like.
We were inspired by Sistema and Unkulo, my project in South Africa. That's a Xhosa word which means both music and reconciliation, is a project that we've dreamed into life based around the extraordinary choral singing in South Africa. In South Africa, far more people sing in choirs than play football or go to the football. Choral singing is an immense part of the local culture there. So we've begun to build something around the amazing daily musical life that takes place there.
A few years ago, when Dr. Abreu was over in this country doing some seminars at the South Bank Centre, he said something that absolutely stuck with me, along the lines of, "Remember, you have nothing to learn from us. We had everything to learn from you." And that's bringing back to the structure that we have in place anyway through our music services. And what he was getting at is that actually they started from nothing, and they had to create something. And it is not actually a music education program, it's a social action program in which the orchestra is a metaphor for collaboration and working in harmony. And the projects here are, it's great that they are happening. And the one detail that we need to stress is that each of the Sistema inspired projects in Scotland and England has a professional orchestra working within the program, so that there's engagement between professional musicians and the children taking part.
It does bring up again the politics of subsidy, an attitude to the arts, Mark, because the idea that somehow they're optional, not vital, and that perhaps, and it's the Elie Wiesel thing, isn't it, that the opposite of love isn't hate, it's indifference.
And that's why we have to make sure that people understand that an orchestra is embedded in the heart of its community and is there as a social resource, that it is a vital tool for creating engagement with children about breaking out of the cycle, perhaps, of individualism and of nothing to do, but providing structure.
Let's have some forward thinking. I'll ask the question again. What is the future of the orchestra?
I am quite sure that people will continue to need to come together to experience the music. It's a collective experience. In our age of faster, quicker, more, it's the one time where we come together and are still together for 2 hours, everyone hearing the same thing. It's a collective experience which has no parallel, and I don't think the need for that will change, but I think the people will be more informed in different ways about how they come to do that. I think the understanding of the orchestra's function as a tool for social change will continue to grow and develop.
Mark, from the ABO's point of
view. I would have to agree with all of that. I mean, it is around in orchestras maintaining their commitment to excellence, reach, and innovation, and using all the digital tools at their disposal to work in partnership with the musician. An orchestra is its musicians as well as its management, and working in partnership to make sure that that orchestra is absolutely embedded as that social, educational, and artistic resource for its community. And that mission is going to absolutely inform the orchestra of the future.
Mark Pemberton, Shirley Apthorpe, it's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you both very much indeed.
Thank you.
That conversation was recorded earlier this evening across the road in the Royal College of Music, and the producer was Helen Garrison. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. This is Andrew McGregor, live at the Royal Albert Hall for the second performance this season from the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir Simon Rattle.
And as you can probably tell from the atmosphere in the hall already, these two concerts have been some of the hottest tickets of the whole season. In the first half, we heard the piano concerto by Brahms that thinks it's a symphony, according to Simon Rattle. In the second half, he's going to conduct what he called the symphony that thinks it's a concerto, Witold Lutosławski's Symphony No. 3, which he finished in 1983, his 70th birthday year. Lutosławski had struggled with the idea of writing a classical symphony in the late 20th century, even while he was writing his second symphony 15 years earlier, wondering out loud whether the symphony was a relic bequeathed to us or perhaps a living organism with years of development still lying ahead of it. Simon Rattle harbours no such doubts about the third symphony.
The Lutosławski is one of the most powerful symphonies of the 20th century, bar none. It stands up to Mahler, to Shostakovich, to Sibelius. The orchestra who played it the last time with Lutosławski himself in the 80s all realized that this is as great a work as any of our standard played symphonies. And after the first concert, we opened the season with the Lutosławski. So many of the orchestra came to me and said, yes, let's play more of this, please. You know, I knew him quite well, and it was wonderful. I found in my score, which I haven't conducted the piece this century, and I found in my score the very first postcard that she sent me before we'd met, and brought back this extraordinary civilized patrician man with the volcano going on in the middle. This wonderful thing Witold said, which is, I sometimes have a dream of waking up where they are only playing contemporary music. Not egocentrically, but just because as a composer now you feel like mustard and the feast of music, and we'd all like to be a beefsteak sometimes. It's very, very typical of him.
Simon Rattle on one of his favourite 20th century composers. And you remember him saying Lutosławski's third is a symphony that thinks it's a concerto? Well, a concerto for orchestra, a virtuoso showpiece that tests the brilliance of any ensemble. It was commissioned for the Chicago Symphony Orchestra some years before they actually received the finished thing, showing how much difficulty Lutosławski had coming to grips with it, abandoning then restarting work on the Third Symphony several times over at least a decade. So he settled on a two-movement form where the first movement is but preparation for what follows. The first movement's supposed to interest, attract and involve, he said, but never to entirely satisfy the listener, who's led to expect something more important, maybe even with impatience, which is exactly the moment the second movement appears and offers the main idea of the work. So in the Third Symphony, we get a short introduction, then the preparatory movement, and then the second movement. No break between the two movements, though. And here to conduct the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra in Witold Lutosławski's Third Symphony is someone who counts himself as one of the composer's biggest fans, Sir Simon Rattle.
Thank you.